Hey, everybody, I'm Nick Layton.
And I'm Leah Bonema.
And we're the hosts of Were You Raised by Wolves?
Each week, we try to make the world a kinder, nicer place.
Well, that's the idea, at least.
I mean, we try.
Have you ever wondered what to do if you're ghosted?
Or what to do when a friend asks you to borrow money?
Or the proper way to eat Cheetos?
You know, the big questions.
So please find Were You Raised by Wolves wherever you listen.
My name is Sarah Kim, and I'm from Austin, Texas. I'm a Cheeselandian because while life is great, cheese makes it better. Go to Cheeselandia.com to learn more, and if it's for you, sign up.
Hi, and welcome to A Taste of the Past. I'm your host, Linda Palacio, on this journey through culinary history. And here on A Taste of the Past, we talk often about recipes and cuisines that tell us so much about the culture and life of a place at a particular time. And if any of you have ever attempted to make a dish from an old, I mean, very old recipe, such as a manuscript cookbook, then you know that it takes some reading between the lines and learning about the history of a place and time, as well as a lot of guesswork on measurements, in order to recreate a dish that is some facsimile of what the original was like. Well, my guest today, Karima Moyer-Noki, spends a lot of time and research doing just that with historical Italian food. And she uses this experience and her studies to conduct what she calls the reconstruction of Italian sociocultural history through the lens of food. As she writes, and I kind of have paraphrased here, we experience history with our senses. We put our hands in the pasta. We smell the heady spices of the Middle Ages and hear the cheese balls crackle as they fry and watch as the past comes together on a plate. Really got a picture of that. And over the past year or so, Karima has focused very specifically on regional pasta and did, I guess, like about 50 posts of some of the lesser...
50 posts.
50, okay. 50 posts of some of the lesser known but important traditional forms. And this year she intends to do even more from a more historical perspective. Although, as she says, the two are often inextricable. Karima Moyer-Noki, born and educated in the U.S., has lived and worked in Italy for the past 30 years. And she's joining us today from Italy by computer. And she is a tenured professor at the University of Siena, as well as a lecturer for the Master in Culinary Studies at the University of Rome, Tor Vergata. Her research explores the effective, political, and economic implications of the invention of traditions. She lectures internationally about issues related to Italian food history, as well as holding classes and demonstrations about the preparation of historical dishes. Welcome, Karima.
Hi, Linda. It's really great to be here in this sort of situation where I can be in Italy. The last time I saw you, I came to your studio in New York.
That's right. That's right. And I think we were talking about your book, which I now have to mention because I didn't do that originally, is that you are the author of two books, Chewing the Fat, An Oral History of Italian Foodways from Fascism to Dolce Vita, and the book for which you were in the studio talking to me about was The Eternal Table, A Cultural History of Food in Rome. And it's so great to be able to talk to you again, even though we couldn't meet up last time I was in Rome. It was just a very brief time. But you live near Siena, right?
Well, I live in Città di Castello, which is in Umbria. I teach at the University of Siena, but there is a branch in Arezzo, which is 45 minutes away from me, whereas Siena is an hour and a half.
That's convenient for sure. Well, you know, and so much of your work has been on not only studying, writing about the history of the food, especially Eternal Table, that was, you know, a huge work. but you really cook the food. I mean, you, as you just said in that phrase that I read, that you really get your hands right in there in the dough. Tell me a little bit about this, the reconstruction, or as you call it, eating history. Tell me a little bit about how you apply that to recreating this Italian sociocultural history.
Yeah, histophagy is a word that I coined myself. The history part is clear, and phagy refers to eating. So it can also be applied to geophagy, for example, is eating dirt, essentially. And and monophagy means that your diet only allows for one specific food. And so this is... engaging with history through eating and the experience, the olfactory experience of taste and smell, and as well as you had said from that piece, hearing the food as it's being prepared, the smell of it, the appearance of it, the texture of it in your hands when you're preparing, and that's all part of that experience of history that I am aiming to create, so that the historical experience of food doesn't remain something that is the haunt of scholars and in food studies programs, but is something that it's another dimension of enjoying food and tracing it through, favorite dishes. For example, on my website, I have Roman macaroni. Macaroni, however, in this sense, being these long noodles, and they are made with bread that's been soaked in goat's milk, mixed with flour and some egg and rose water, which was very historically important. So you feel all that and squeeze the bread that's been soaking in the goat's milk, mixing it then with your hands and just having that total experience of history, and then also communing with it by then eating it.
Right. I mean, to just read, in a vacuum of, this history, I mean, to be able to actually, attempt, not everybody's going to, be interested in wanting to cook, but how could they not want to taste what they're reading about? It's always beyond me. And obviously a lot of times it's impossible, but
when I do historical dinners, it's such a joy to share that kind of thing and take that history trip together with people who haven't necessarily prepared the food. But then having someone, for example, who pairs the wine, and then people reading certain things that they've looked up, so that it really revives that concept of conviviality.
Right, right. And I have to say, if anyone who wants to take a look, and people who know your Instagram feed, are addicted to it, I'm sure. It's your Instagram feed is at Historical Italian Food, and I'm going to go to the edge saying that it's almost food porn. I mean, it's almost pasta porn. It is. It's absolutely beautiful. I will watch it without the sound, and then I'll put the sound on and hear the music or your instructions and your voices. I mean, it's very, very well done. And in today's world with, Instagram, I almost called the show Pandemic Pasta, but I thought that was not doing it. That was doing it a dishonor. But people are so, I mean, what, a lot of people who have been, stuck at home, they have gone to making, of course, we all know about the sour bread craze, but a lot of people are also learning to make their own pastas and just, cooking dishes that they will see listed. And your Instagram feed goes much further, is another step, because you are really teaching us about history. You're really instructing us then how to make these dishes. How did you come up to do this? I mean, what inspired you to do this on Instagram?
Well, the same thing with my website. I mean, I started my website and started going on Instagram at the same time. I'm developing a project around pasta. I also wanted to promote the historical meals that I prepare. But I've started on a specific project in pasta and in historical pasta, regional pasta. A lot of people doing regional, but I want to look at it through the lens of history. Mm-hmm. So it really was a complement to that and to get people interested, which was at the same time going to motivate me to continue doing my work. I say to people will write to me and say, oh, this is just so lovely and thank you. And I say that this is what makes it worth it to me. So bringing that to people and sharing, it's like now I can't have a historical meal out or at my home or travel. And I do it now through Instagram. And so there is, I'm very pleased about the interest. And it's also part of it as well is that I would like to develop some of my work then into another, my third book. And these days it's important to show that you have a presence on social media. And so there is also a very pragmatic aspect to it as well.
Well, of course, people who listen to my show regularly know that I do a lot of shows on Italian food, and I've done quite a few on pastas, history of the noodle, really, and of course we could do tons of shows on that because it's such a foggy history and foggy area, and you have really focused more on let's really get to the point of where it's pasta, but so. Karima, what would you, I mean, a lot of these forms of the dough, as you say, rolled out dough and whatever, except for Horace, calling it a pasta. What is some of the oldest known pasta that we can actually call pasta?
Well, one of the oldest is testaroli, which is said to date back to the Etruscans. There are unreliable sources. I like to look at those as well, but just to get the idea. But there are unreliable sources that also say it dates back to the Bronze Age, when there was this porridge that was poured over hot stones. Because the way that this is made, now this is something that is Etruscan, so we're talking about Tuscany, and in particular the Lunigiana area. And the way that this is made is it's not rolled out, but it's a batter that is poured onto a round griddle that has been heated very hot over usually beech wood. And this is how they do it when they do a historical reconstruction of this. So you have what's called a testo, a testum, which is something that existed in Roman times. On top of that, you put a domed lid, which has also been heated over the fire. Pour the water and flour batter in, cover it up, and then it will cook itself. So when it's done, you scrape it out of the testum. You leave it to cool. It gets cut up into rhomboidal shapes, which is also a shape that was kind of mystical and important for the time. And then it's a cool pasta, but not a dried pasta. And so it's kind of like a bread, but it doesn't finish there because the way that it's cooked then is that you boil it in water. And it's dressed these days with a very rudimentary pesto made with basil and olive oil and a little bit of cheese. So, and this is kind of the link between the past and now that has had a continuation that that can be traced a little bit more clearly. However, pasta came about, the linguistic, the terminology points towards lasagna as something that is rolled out and then cut up and cooked. Yes.
Yeah. Well, often a lot of the old lasagna that we read about in old texts, or they referred to the noodle as a lasagna, was a sweet dish. Is that something you came across?
There are a lot of pasta dishes that have sugar. Now, part of what you might be talking about is the a very intense appreciation and use of sugar as you're getting into the Middle Ages, which was as most things are about food. It's about class. It's about showing who you are, showing what you own, showing what your prowess, your economic prowess is. So for example, when we get to Maestro Martino, his pasta has his pasta noodles, which are like tagliatelle, they also have sugar on them. The dish that I was talking about before, Bartolomeo Scappi, Roman macaroni, it has sugar, but it's not because it was a dessert, but because there wasn't a distinction between savory and sweet.
Right, like the very expensive spices that one would use to show off, and right, so sugar was a
exactly. Sugar was part of it, and sugar was considered a spice anyway,
mm-hmm.
as well.
Exactly, right. But as you said, I mean, lasagna was, you know, there are a lot of different dishes, in, you know, and then continued on through Apicius, right? And we'll see a lot of in the first few centuries AD, a lot of lasagna type dishes, a lot of layered pasta dishes or pasta.
And important to remember as well about lasagna that it's both a pasta shape and a dish, so that it mm-hmm. would later develop into becoming the concept of something that was layered.
Layered, right.
But you also have noodles, which are called lasagne, and they're 3 fingers wide. My fingers are very small, so just think about that. And it's a long noodle that was then cooked, but like a very wide pappardelle. So those were also lasagne. And then all of the different things that are called sagne.
Lasagne. So they had sagne.
Right, which tend to be smaller patches of lasagne. But then I'm getting very specific here.
Yeah, no, that's good. They came in various different shapes, right?
Right, different shapes and there's an interesting recipe from 1390, the Form of Curry English book, which has a recipe for macaron, which talk about the lasagne shape. Okay, now that's also a heraldic form, which is the shape of a diamond. And these were as well kind of put on the platter in layers with butter and cheese. And this is a mention of a recipe that appears around the same time that the first recipe is appearing in Italian. So, and I have this theory about when the first Jubilee years were starting and that sort of exchange, as well as the international Gothic. But it's interesting that this pasta dish called macaroon was already in 1390 in England.
Right. Yes, indeed. I mean, especially to be put in that book in the form of the Form of Curry, the name of the book, as you mentioned. Mm. That's really quite interesting. Pasta was not always just hand rolled and handmade. They almost had, I mean, they had groups of people, or as you mentioned, guilds of people, so that it was almost mechanized from a very early age. Is that correct?
Well, you have the if you jump up then to the 1500s, then you're starting to have the separation of guilds. And the macaronai and the vermicellai are separating from millers and bakers and actually becoming their own thing. mechanized is going to take a while to develop. However, one of the first indications, of course, this is relatively well known if anyone knows their Italian history, is the mention by Al-Idirisi in Sicily of the mention of pasta, that he is noting the commercial production and shipment of pasta already in the 1100s, so in the 12th century.
Right. That's what I was referring to, actually. Right.
Okay. Right. So Al-Idirisi, he was the cartographer for Roger II in Sicily, when previously Sicily had been dominated by the Arabs, for which there's this speculation about whether or not it was the Arabs who had developed pasta, but that's a very sticky kind of situation there.
Right. Well, that was something that I kind of figured this would be, I would focus only on the Italian making of pasta, because then we get into, just as you mentioned, and
yes.
People saying, well, no, it was the Chinese. They found some old noodles that were made some other kind of grain. And then some say, no, it's the Arabs, because we had, similar dishes. But Italy really kept this tradition specific to their cuisine. And it does have a very specific history. And when did we see some of these more specific shapes coming that have endured through the centuries?
So there's a huge problem in Italian culinary history, which is this, that the first cookbook that exists in Italy is Apicius, and then there is not another one. And I say this with trepidation in my heart. There's not another one for centuries. Not only is there not another cookbook, but the Dark Ages were truly dark for culinary history in Italy, as far as pasta goes, that there's no mention in any text until you get well into the High Middle Ages. So you're getting into and that's when the mentions start. And you can tell by the way it's being mentioned and the names that are being used, that a certain amount of development has already taken place that we're unable to trace, except to say that the first time it's mentioned that we have is maybe the first mentions are starting at the end of the 13th century. So I hope in my lifetime that some other texts are going to surface, because it's just far too long to not have any information whatsoever. Someone must have written something.
Right.
But you have, so you have these, the regional shapes, but you have at that point, the macro shapes, which, you have the lasagne. So the macro shapes are lasagne, gnocchi, which also, being given their rudimentary kind of way that they're made, are said to maybe have existed before the lasagne, which actually requires rolling things out. Gnocchi, of course, not with potatoes, because the Columbian exchange had not, it was centuries away.
Right.
But then long pasta, tagliatelle, the regional shapes, the ravioli, pasta parcels, stuff was starting to be put inside pasta. And that is a little bit more reliably traceable to the Arab tradition, mm-hmm. where ravioli is said to have arrived through the trade and mobility that's going on with the Arab nations, or what do we call them at that point. And it arrived wrapped. So it arrived as a pasta parcel with stuff inside, not necessarily boiled. And then it went through a period of time where the raviolo was actually the morsel or the entity that was inside the pasta. And so it lost the pasta and it lost that meaning for a period of time and predominantly became the little dumpling thing. And so that was ravioli. After that, then it started late Middle Ages to go back into its pasta wrapper because people found how delicious it was. And then regional shapes developed with regional identities and competition of, well, you do it this way and we do it that way and ours is better.
My name is Sarah Kim and I'm from Austin, Texas. I'm a Cheeselandian because while life is great, cheese makes it better. Wisconsin cheese has proven time and time again to be a delicious expression of craft, hard work, and tradition. As a Cheeselandian, I am able to share a Gouda experience with fellow cheese and food lovers nationwide, as well as connect with cheese producers and cheesemongers, taking my love of cheese to another level. I invite you to join Cheeselandia because during these difficult times, it has been even more important to take it easy and get cheesy. The Cheeselandia community and events have been the glue helping to keep us together and connected, and I would love it if you would join me. And let's face it, if you hear the word cheese and get a little hungry, then you've found a place you can call home. To find out more about Cheeselandia, go to cheeselandia.com.
Jumping ahead into more modern history, there are a lot of regional dishes, and even those that make pastas and fillings. But getting into the whole filled pasta, and then we get into the dumpling dichotomy of whose pasta is pasta and whose is first. But the types of regional pastas that are even made with different flours, or not even a flour, but a grain. I'm thinking particularly of like pizzicati. Are there other regional pastas such as that you can give us an example of, or tell us about pizzicati?
That are not made with
That are just very specific to a particular region.
There's a lot of, with rural revivalism and all of the intensity of claiming shapes and foods as yours and as a tradition, it's very intense in Italy, and saving both for commercial and affective reasons. It brings in money, saying this is our thing, and when you go to our town, this is what you need to eat. So there are a lot of the pizzicati are a pasta that is made with buckwheat. There are other ones, these wonderful dish from Friuli called lasagnette, little discs that are put into a cocotte that are layered then with mushroom sauce and cabbage. A lot of things that are known in their area. This is kind of the sad thing that I would like to, for which I'm doing my work. A lot of wonderful traditions are eclipsed sort of in the way that heritage fruit and vegetables have been eclipsed and need to be not necessarily revived, but brought out into the light, because there are so many other things other than lasagna alla bolognese. Not that that isn't absolutely delicious, but with partially with COVID and people are getting more specific about their things, but there are about 1,300 different pasta names, huh, of which I think are 1,000 or something, of which there are probably then within that 300 different pasta shapes. So that are so sometimes not even discernible.
Okay? Right. I was going to say there's got to be a fine line between a lot of those shapes.
No, very fine. Yeah.
I mean, books
very
have
fine,
been
but even,
written.
Even if you think about, yeah,
And I look at, you know, a lot of the books you'll look at and they'll maybe only have 50 or 100 shapes and say, well, but I know that there's this other shape I had in this other village that, you know, was very similar, but the name's not there. Well, that has to do with dialect, obviously, and, you know, regionality, yeah. I would imagine. Amazing. So you think about 300 different, really different shapes.
300 shapes that want to claim themselves as being different. Now, if we're talking, for example, let's use the example of sometimes it's about the relationship with the food, because it doesn't just end with the shape. The relationship that a town has and the identity and the importance of that identity, peachy in Siena, hand-rolled long pasta. Now they're going to eat that classically with the tomato sauce made with aglione, the very large, I think it's called elephant garlic in the U.S. or something, but that very large garlic, it's a sauce with tomato and garlic that's from the Valdichiana. Okay, so this garlic, and then there's all of this, well, the garlic has to be grown in the Valdichiana and et cetera to get its terroir thing. So there's peachy, and then you go to Umbria, which has the same kind of shape, where they're called umbricelli. But the Umbrians are not going to be eating it with that Sienese sauce ever, okay? They're never going to take their umbricelli and combine it with that thing. They're going to put on, you know, maybe what's called a white meat sauce, meaning that it doesn't have a tomato base. Some other kind of thing. And the relationship that they have with the pasta and the way that it's prepared already and also makes it something different.
Right. Well, and interesting for our listeners to remember too, is that, you know, which, you know, you talk about and we recognize, but that, you know, they think pasta and they immediately think tomato sauce. And of course, we know that, you know, that didn't come until way, you know, much later, until the, you know, the 16th century easily. So that's
right. So you don't have tomatoes coming in, and then it took so long for them to be combined with pasta. It just wasn't a thing. The first recipe that you have putting together durum wheat pasta with a very simple tomato sauce comes in 1837 with Ippolito Cavalcante. So that's very late.
Right.
Spaghetti, and interestingly, it doesn't associate, even though it's a recipe coming out of Naples, it's made with lardo, so cured fatback. And it's not made with olive oil. It doesn't have meatballs in it. But tomatoes, of course, tomatoes took a very long time to catch on, also because it's a flavor, and there's the suspicion about it being from the nightshade family, and
that's
so
right.
being poisonous, and then all of the occasions of trying the leaves instead of the fruit, and so those, of course, were poisonous and not tasty. So a lot of suspicion about it being from the Belladonna or nightshade family, and took a while to. It wasn't filling people's stomachs like corn polenta. That caught on much more easily because it resolved a filling your stomach problem amongst the poor in the north. Potatoes also took a long time. But for the reason that they were something that was grown underground, and things that there was a hierarchy of foods, things that were grown underground were for poor people. Did it take the place then of something that was sacred like bread, because it's another starch? So the problems there with potatoes as well, catching on, even though they caught on before tomatoes did.
Right. Well, there's so much more that we could talk about, and we can talk about, I mean, you do wonderful recreation of other dishes, not just pasta. But one question I wanted to ask to see, and I don't even know if you have this, if this is documented, is when did pasta become, like a first course dish, a primo piatto, in the structure of Italian meals?
Okay. I don't know how much time I have, so I'll try to...
Go for it. Just go for it.
...to address that. Oh, okay. I'll just go for it, and you can cut me off when you want. So, because unfortunately, we do have to go back to the ancient Romans and say... This was about conviviality, of separating a meal. They were very much about using food to establish civility and social class, separating the riffraff from, and separating themselves as Romans from the barbarians. Okay, so we have that. And the division of the meal into... You arrive and you have your nibbles and you have a little bit of mead and some molson, which is spiced wine. You mm-hmm. have your prima mensa, your maybe two prima mensa and a seconda mensa, and then you get into your drinking. So as that moves through time, that civility of remaining at the table because everything isn't brought out to you as if you were being slopped. So... things are brought out in courses and there's entertainment, etc. And that was the way that the aristocrats ate. And keeping in mind that people always aspired, regardless of our veneration of the rustic cuisine, etc., they did not venerate rustic. They always wanted to imitate their so-called betters. So moving through time, and that develops in a different way in the Middle Ages and the Renaissance. And then you have... After Bartolomeo Scappi, who is 1570, the hegemony of French cuisine. 200 years of a dominance of French culture that completely eclipsed Italian cuisine. France was the center of culinary culture. And as they developed, they did not have pasta, but what they have is soup. Soup right. becomes very important as the first dish. So you have the developments in the 19th century of industrial pasta. Pasta is becoming more available to people, okay? It's still not a dish of culinary identity, also because that commercial pasta starts to be associated with Naples and cholera and filth and other sorts of things. So moving through time, the importance of soup, the importance of France... having that as a first plate, what do you do with pasta? It doesn't have its own category. So it starts to be put into the soup category because there's a certain logic that says pasta is boiled in water or boiled in broth. It was often done in broth. And so in that sort of way, let's just call it a soup. Una minestra. La minestra, which is a lovely word because it also comes from ministrare, which means to nurse people, to take care of people. It's kind of a very loving word. So when I first moved to Italy 30 years ago, there's the generation that was still calling pasta la minestra, still calling it soup, even though it then separated into being pasta asciutta and pasta in brodo, dry pasta that you eat without broth, and then pasta in brodo, so.
Right.
Moving into the fascist era, you've got a very distinct break with France, even though it's going to take time for people who are still looking to France for fashion culture, for culinary culture. That's going to take a little bit of time, but Mussolini made the poor Italian foods a venerated part because of his politics. He needed to look inward. He needed to have that autarky, that isolation of Italy. We're going to forge on ahead on our own, which then he hooked up with Germany. But he needed people to embrace those poor foods, which is pasta, polenta, rice, potatoes, those sorts of things.
Right.
But you still don't have enough people who have enough money to be eating pasta all the time, let alone have a first course and a second course. So that really happens after World War II, because having done extensive research with speaking with 90-year-old women, and that just wasn't something that people did. You just didn't have the money until the economic miracle took place. And then aspiring to eat like upper-class people meant having a first course and a second course. You didn't necessarily have the money to do it, and pasta was a cheap way to eat, industrial pasta in particular, because that's when you have the changeover from making pasta by hand and buying it. Buying food became very important. Buying juice in a box meant that you had money.
Right.
You had industrial pasta, and that meant you had leisure time.
And time is what we don't have right now, unfortunately.
Okay, but okay. There you go.
And there's so much more information. And your answer, you basically got all the different factors in there from, pasta is political.
Okay.
To pasta is also your money. So it has such a history,
right.
And it is so wonderful. We can say it's the ultimate comfort food, right? And I think that...
Yes, absolutely.
At this point, we're going to leave it at that. And I wish you so much luck in your new project with a new book. And in the meantime, I look forward to your next post on one of your beautiful demonstrations of your cooking. Okay. And if you haven't had the chance to see Karima's wonderful work on Instagram, once again, her Instagram handle is @historicalitalianfood. And Karima, it's always a pleasure to hear more information from you than I could possibly get in okay. months of studying, years of studying. Karima Moyer Noki, thank you very much. And thank you for listening.
Thank you. It was such a pleasure. I am talking about a topic that I absolutely adore.
So. I can tell.
Thank you.
And again, this has been A Taste of the Past.
A Taste of the Past is powered by Simplecast. Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. For our freshest content, subscribe to our newsletter. Enter your email at the bottom of our website, heritageradionetwork.org. Connect with us on Instagram and Twitter @heritage_radio. You can also find us at facebook.com/heritageradionetwork. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization driving conversations to make the world a better, fairer, and more delicious place. And we couldn't do it without support from listeners like you. Want to be part of the food world's most innovative community? Subscribe to the shows you like. Tell your friends. And please join the HRN family by becoming a member. Just click on the heart at the top right of our homepage. Thanks for listening.
Hey, are you hungry? Well, you're in luck. Meat and Three is back for season 16. I'm Taylor Early, and we've got a whole new batch of reporters I am so excited to introduce you to.
Hi, I'm Elizabeth Fisher.
Asha McElroy.
Sam Girardi.
Jessica Gingrich.
Hannah from Wisconsin.
I'm a swing dancing audio engineer.
I am a future registered dietitian nutritionist.
I'm from New York, and I love rice and beans.
My favorite food of all time is a shrimp burrito.
I love watermelon.
We've also got a bonus podcast for you called Behind the Internship. Three of our reporters will take you along to show how they develop stories for this very show, Meat and Three.
Hi, I'm Danielle Flitter, a plant-based chef from Philadelphia, living in Mexico City.
I'm Sophia Hooper. I'm a bartender based in Portland, Maine.
My name is Addison Austin Liu. I am a chef and food journalist from Salt Lake City, Utah, and my favorite food is Peruvian.
Rice and beans.
Hand-drawn noodle soup.
So tune in to enjoy a square meal for your ears. And I hope you saved a little room for dessert.